You're listening to 97.3 LP FM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source RVA, the parties may be over, but we continue ringing in the new year with our look back at the arts that were and the arts yet to be created in Richmond in 2013. We've convened yet another panel of experts. Join our theater, music, and visual arts pros as they walk us through the ups and downs of Richmond's art scene. But first, the news.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The board of directors of the Firehouse Theater Project may be knuckling under for a fight as they rebuff calls to rehire former artistic director Carol Pearsall, but their prospective audience, actors, and crew members are talking about a revolution. In a half-page advertisement set to run next week in Style Weekly, a group of actors, directors, crew members, and dedicated patrons have penned a 1776-style Declaration of Independence from the board of the Firehouse Theater Project, citing intolerable acts, specifically their vote to oust Pearsall on December 12th. The open letter is signed by about 125 people, including other former founders of the theater, a variety of well-known names in Richmond theater and arts, and a number of notable benefactors. It's the latest volley in the ongoing war of words over the future of the Firehouse. The current board has expressed its desire to take the theater and transform it into a Tier 1 institution in the vein of Center Stage. Meanwhile, the Firehouse earned its reputation as a nurturing haven for emerging playwrights and artists, some of whom have taken their craft onto larger venues and great acclaim. Governor Bob McDonnell appointed a slew of officials this past week. Margaret Schultz of the Virginia Department of Social Services will ascend from Deputy Commissioner to Acting Commissioner. She's been with Social Services since 97. Martin Brown, who Schultz will succeed as Social Services Commissioner, will now serve in the office of the governor as special advisor to McDonnell for family reintegration of state offenders. Dr. Cynthia Romero, manager of a private family medicine office and chief medical officer of Chesapeake Regional Medical Center, will be taking the place of former Virginia Health Commissioner Karen Remley, who resigned from the Board of Health in October. At the time of her resignation, Remley informed the governor that she could no longer head the department in good faith, citing Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli's strong-arm tactics and other alleged political maneuvering in passing new Board of Health regulations that subject state abortion clinics to stringent new construction standards. According to Virginia Public Access Project data, Dr. Romero has contributed over $2,000 to Republican campaigns since 2001. Jenny Wortham is the new Chief Deputy Director of the Virginia Commission for the Arts. She previously worked in legislative affairs and information systems and at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. 12 other appointments to 9 other boards and commissions were announced on the governor's website, with more to come soon. TED Talks are coming to Richmond. The popular technology, entertainment, and design conference series has been around in some form or another since 1983. But has expanded exponentially in recent years with their X conferences, meant to denote independently organized TED Talks. The event itself happens on March 22nd and will be a 12-hour affair from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., but not all the slots for speakers have been filled yet. TEDx RVA organizers declared on their website, TEDxRVA.com, that they want to give everyone an opportunity to be an additional TEDx speaker, so they will hold an open mic night at the Hippodrome on January 31st, where wannabes will have 2 minutes to pitch their ideas worth spreading, and the audience will vote electronically to decide whether these ideas should be spread or maybe just kept in the dark. Those unable to make the open mic night can still fill out a speaker application on the website. All of this information and more can be found at TEDxRVA.com.
Richmond prides itself on its status as an arts town, but are local officials and big money arts patrons dimming the spotlight, possibly even sabotaging the impressive performances coming out of the city's flourishing arts and music scene? It sure seemed that way in 2012, a year that saw onstage triumphs and backstage soap operas, Hollywood glamour and critical applause, and debates over everything from where it's appropriate to present art to where you can legally park to experience it. This past year, we saw key figures in the arts exiting the stage, most of them unwillingly or with accompanying controversy, as well as a cast of new leaders who are getting ready for their close-ups. For this special edition of Open Source RVA, we have convened a special panel of writers, critics, and culture watchers to help us look back on the year that was and figure out whether or not we went too far off script. Joining us today are Richmond Magazine senior writer Harry Kolatz, a founding member of the Firehouse Theater Project, Style Weekly classical music reporter and former Times Dispatch critic Angela Lehman Rios, writer and reporter Rich Grissett, who is one of Style's theater critics, and RVA Magazine scribe and managing editor Andrew Nietzsche. We'll not only look back, we'll also ask our distinguished guests for their predictions on what waits in the wings for 2013. Now we send you to our moderator, Don Harrison, a man who really wants to direct. Don?
When we look back on the year in the arts in Richmond, Harry, what are most of us going to remember from 2012, if we remember anything at all?
Well, I hope we'll remember some things. I certainly will. These are just a few things that I sort of would cast my mind back. The G40 Art Summit, which brought an enormous attention to Richmond for international figures in wall art, paired up with the RVA Flood Wall Festival, which
the street art festival
that really, for once, actually used that incredibly ugly flood wall for something other than putting up faded banners on.
Yeah, and I enjoyed how every time I went down there, there was a new crowd out there, sort of enjoying it too. It was had a nice
and it did what it was supposed to do, and all of these things did. It brought people into the streets to look at the process of this work and to enjoy that activity. I also wanted to point out that the Richmond Triangle Players turned 20 this year, which is a very important milestone for that company, but also it says something about Richmond, that they embraced this organization. Mm-hmm. It's moved into beautifully industrial Scott's Addition after being born in the upstairs of the manger of Fielding, so the
and
old nightclub.
They've become a real force in the theater scene.
Indeed they have, and there's a place for them, and they made that niche, and I'm glad that they're out there. You know, and there's also been some interesting uses of film and music together. I liked Gold Rush accompanying Battleship Potemkin at the Virginia Museum. I just thought that was a very interesting way to interpret that film, an old War Horse classic that's been shown in every art house and film class for, you know, a century. And then also I thought there was an interesting year for dance. And we had the Dogtown Dance Theater and the Ground Zero Dance Company do some pretty incredible shows there. Thinking of a particular of Only Connect and other shows that were there as well. And Star Foster's remounting of her Alice that she did last year. I think that was she did some new parts of that, and that was really quite enjoyable to watch. And
we had the Richmond Ballet also.
And Malcolm Byrne and his, I think he's been there, this is his 30th year, I think, with the museum, with the ballet. So, and they had their first European tour this year, or this past year. And so that brings some name recognition back to us for other things other than baseball or basketball. Right. Excuse me, not baseball. Well,
yeah.
That's a whole other show. It's a whole other show.
Angela, what were some of the what was the takeaway of 2012 for you? What thrilled you?
Well, in 2011, we got a new chamber ensemble in Richmond, the Atlantic Chamber Ensemble, formed by about 12 musicians, all of whom have ties to the Richmond Symphony in one way or another. But they formed a chamber ensemble, so for them, 2012 was a year of building and developing more programs.
And they were sponsored by WCVE, was that right?
They were an ensemble in residence for a year.
They aren't doing that now.
But that was a great way to start. So they've had a good year, and it's been excellent to see them persisting, growing, inviting more musicians to come in, be guest artists, and so on. The Richmond Symphony musicians who, and we'll talk later about some of the problems.
Yes,
with
some of their labor dispute.
Labor dispute. But I think as a result of that, a lot of musicians who in the past had been fine with just going to play and going home have sort of reassessed how they are part of the community. And they've many musicians have been more actively getting music out of the concert hall. And in particular, there's this organization called Classical Revolution, which is a very decentralized movement of getting music, classical music, out of concert halls into bars, museums, parks, and so on. So just this past October or so, Classical Revolution, RVA, formed. And in fact, last night down below, I brought my cello and played a little bit with it's like pickup music.
You're talking about at the Camel?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So I'll talk more about that later. But anyway, that was an exciting thing to see happen as mm-hmm. I think maybe a direct or at least indirect result of some of the conflicts with orchestra management. As far as specific concerts, the Atlantic Chamber Ensemble, they had a great performance called Moved in the spring where they every piece they played either was related to movement somehow. They did a piece with they did two with dancers from Amaranth Dance Company, and then they did a piece where each movement had a video that went with it, like kids in a skate park.
Mm-hmm.
They played this music, a recording beforehand,
right.
and got the kids to sort of do their stuff.
Yeah, kind of putting it in a different
exactly.
setting.
Exactly, and some of those I thought were excellent because the videos were shot here in Richmond, and it just made the music even more relevant.
Mm-hmm.
At the Maudlin Center, the Philip Glass Festival this past fall
right.
was a standout. I didn't get to the main event, which was Philip Glass himself performing and a violinist. But Ensemble and Rest, I heard, and I didn't go, but Eighth Blackbird, which is Ensemble in Residence.
Mm-hmm. Love those guys.
Grammy-nominated Eighth Blackbird.
Thousands of Grammy nominations. I can't even count them on my fingers and toes.
I once
they
saw them
had
play a card table.
Yeah, well, and
it was great.
I think they're going to do it again coming up this spring for the John Cage celebration.
Good.
Anyway, so they had a great concert as part of the Glass Festival. The Richmond Symphony in the spring, they did with the Richmond Ballet, they did Rodeo, Aaron
mm-hmm,
Copland's
mm-hmm.
piece, which was great. And they've started this fall, they've started Rush Hour concerts, which are small
yeah.
programs in the Gottwald Playhouse
mm-hmm.
of the center stage, which I think is a good use for that space. It's a wonderful, intimate
mm-hmm.
place to be to see a smaller version of the symphony.
And are they they're still doing those, right?
They did one in the fall. There's one coming up this spring that I'm going to. It's sort of their trimmed down version, plus you get a glass of wine, of the concert that they perform in Ashland
right.
the following week.
Again, it's presenting classical music in a different way to perhaps get the attention of those who wouldn't normally go to a concert.
It's so different. I mean, there's still people sitting there playing things and people sitting here watching them in
right.
quiet rows. You're closer. You're a lot closer.
Yeah.
And there was just a much more collegial atmosphere with people talking about the music, about their feelings about the music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really magical to not have a proscenium arch and stage
right.
and so on. And then not in the classical mode, but Red Barat came to the Maudlin Center,
right.
and that was an awesome concert. And I hope they come back again, and I hope they play their music walking down
yeah,
the street.
Yeah, the Maudlin really pushed that
yeah.
show, too.
It was fantastic.
They were proud of that one.
And then another little one that I enjoyed at Balasso was the Richmanian Ramblers a couple weeks ago, and I got their CD, and I love to play it in the car. My younger daughter loves it. It drives my older daughter crazy.
What kind of music is it again?
It's a Hungarian,
mm-hmm.
Romanian,
mm-hmm.
gypsy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rich, what stuck out for you this year? Any outstanding works of theater?
There were quite a lot. I think the biggest story that we've had, well, I guess the most positive story that's a big story, would be the official forming of Virginia Repertory Theater. That's Barksdale Theater and Theater 4.
Mm-hmm,
They've
mm-hmm.
been kind of operating together, but now they're officially one organization, one board,
right.
with one roof.
But people still call them Barksdale and Theater 4. I don't think it's really sunk in with a lot of the general
people still call the
public.
You know, the landmark, the mosque, or I guess it's maybe the Altria. It's not official yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Richmond. Things don't change that quickly. We
right,
like
right.
to hang on to.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, they're also seem to be moving in a direction that they're producing maybe not edgier works, but works that cater to a younger audience.
Mm-hmm.
You had God of Carnage. You know, they were doing The Producers currently. The Spring Awakening, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, those are all
right. Sort of mixing commercial fare with more edgy stuff. I think you said there was a Mark Rothko?
That's coming up.
Bio?
I think that's in March.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Red, and they're going to put it in their black box space downtown.
Right.
So there will be that, but they're also mixing. They're going to be doing Hay Fever, if you like Noel Coward.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be coming up soon. So they've got a lot going on. They've got four different theater spaces at this point, so they seem to just be doing more stuff.
Plus their stage out in Hanover County in the old
Yeah.
Barksdale Place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So so they're moving along. Sycamore Rouge is still here.
Almost bit the dust.
Almost bit the dust. Luckily, they're still here.
They're in Petersburg.
They're in Petersburg. Yeah. They're one of the arts organizations down there. Their mission is to revitalize Petersburg and, mm-hmm. and be a force down there. They basically lost sponsorship from the Cameron Foundation. And so they were afraid they were going to lose their space. Luckily, they worked something out, and they have a smaller space that's just down about a block away. Mm-hmm. And they just did Our Town there. And they have a co-production coming up with Richmond Triangle, which is also, you know, they turned 20 this year, mm-hmm. and they seem to be doing just fine.
Right. Andrew, what about you? What about the world of music? What struck you in the world of local music?
Well, as far as live music lately, I feel like there's been a lot of really diverse and excellent music being put on at Balasso. Mm-hmm. Chris Bobst is booking a lot of great stuff of all genres, everything from, like, recently White Laces and the Trillions. It's hands down the best stuff. Anna Shea Kalilia. Classical Incarnations has played there, and mm-hmm. there's the RVA Big Band. He brings in all kinds of
stuff. Yeah, the diversity is really striking.
It's really impressive. And, I mean, of course, I grew up as a partisan of the local hardcore and metal scenes, and they're still going really strong. Mark Osborne, who books at Strange Matter, has brought in a lot of really good and unusual touring acts, the kind of groups that don't really play out.
Yeah.
Like, he had a band called Sun, who are four people who are from four different countries who play, like, an ambient drone. It's very loud, mm-hmm. Kind of experimental music, and they were playing a festival in Raleigh, and he got them to do one date in Richmond, and that was, like, their only other tour date in America on that tour. So it's been really impressive to see some of the groups he's brought in, but, of course, there's a lot of local activity going on mm-hmm. at Strange Matter, at the Camel, at Balasso, somewhat at Kingdom as well, down in Chaco Bottom. I'm really impressed with how much is going on in the local hip-hop scene, considering when I was growing up, you didn't see much of that around here for a really long time, but suddenly there are all these different cliques and people who, you know, you'll have one guy who's booking shows that 20 other people are performing on, and there are half a dozen of those different groups around town who are doing entire hip-hop showcases. You can go see that probably once a week. Mm-hmm. You can see really great shows in almost any genre. And that's been just really impressive because for a long time, I mean, I love it, but yeah, Richmond was kind of a bare-bones town if you were into hardcore or metal. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like it's become a lot more diverse.
It looked as though the bigger acts or the more interesting acts were bypassing us.
Well, and that's true too, and you really have to hand it to, like, the National, who have brought in a lot of groups mm-hmm. that before the National was there would not have performed in Richmond at all.
Right.
You know, I saw the Flaming Lips there.
Like St. Vincent
was
fantastic.
Absolutely. I'm really surprised and pleased with just how well the live music scene here mm-hmm. has developed, specifically over the last year, but really over the last several. And, you know, I've always thought Richmond was a great town, but I felt like it didn't get enough recognition outside of Richmond. But now you're starting to see a more widespread appreciation for this city as a destination city for mm-hmm. national touring acts. And I think that's great.
Well, people have been saying that it's the year of Matthew E. White. His big inner CD garnered a lot of critical acclaim, and he was really the toast of the music festival circuit.
True.
That was maybe the most hyped release of the year.
Yes, I would agree with that. The interesting thing about Matthew E. White is that I think he really wouldn't have gotten quite as far had he not worked with the Mountain Goats, mm-hmm, who are a longstanding indie band who put out, I don't know, their 15th or 20th album. I mean, something... Yeah, and he
kind
did
of College Rock Darlings.
Right, and he did the horn charts for that album and got local Richmond musicians involved with playing the horn parts on the record. And then when he toured with the Mountain Goats, he opened up for them, and then his backing band also backed mm-hmm. the Mountain Goats. And, of course, he's also associated with Reggie Pace, who's involved with Bon Iver. And, yeah, they do have a lot of cachet on that kind of more middle-of-the-road indie rock scene that is very, you know, the kind of music, it's very placid and calm, and people of all generations can appreciate it. My personal qualm with making Matthew E. White the dominant story of 2012 in Richmond is that although the only reason Lamb of God have gotten much discussion is because of what happened to Randy in the Czech Republic, that has completely been like overshadowed the fact that their new album Resolution, which came out in January, hit number 3 on the Billboard album charts and was certainly, if you want to talk about an album that was the biggest album to come out of Richmond this year, Lamb of God is it. And people are not giving them the credit that they deserve because everybody's too busy talking about this horrible murder charge, which I personally think it's very unlikely that Randy is responsible for. But
yet they are bringing, they have brought charges against him.
They have, and I don't know. I believe whatever the courts decide, but it doesn't sound to me like there's any kind of overwhelming evidence.
Yeah, just to summarize, Lamb of God had played a show in the Czech Republic
in 2010.
A fan got on stage and Randy Blythe basically pushed him off. Well, this resulted in the fan dying.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's no evidence that Randy actually pushed the guy off. There are video footage of the show available on the internet, and you can watch security guards dumping one guy really brutally onto his head. And you could see guys running by Randy and him kind of putting his arm on their back as they jump off. And so the combination of the two, it looks like if anything that we've seen, now the footage isn't of the entire concert, but if anything we've seen publicly, it seems like the security guards were probably at fault. Now, I don't know what the Czech Republic knows, probably a lot more than I do.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm definitely taking the stand that he's presumed innocent until found guilty. But regardless, the fact that Lamb of God had such a high-selling, high-charting album is really not getting reported on. And I think that's because we are, as a city, used to the hardcore and metal scenes producing popular like bands. And so it's not a story anymore. So Matthew White, he's done a lot. And he's a popular and talented musician who deserves all the success he's getting. But I think to some extent people are so excited for that kind of story that they're talking about it when maybe it's not as big as people are representing it to be.
Right. And, you know, probably the local CD I listened to most was probably about the Trillions, Tritones CD, which I really liked. Also, the Dead Fame Frontiers.
Sure. Well, the Trillions in particular, we've been pushing them really hard at RVA Magazine for a long time because we think they're one of the best pop rock groups coming out of Richmond. We put them in the magazine before they even had a full length out, and we need to go back and cover them again because they're doing really well in the wake of the
really good songwriting.
Yeah. The thing is, I hear a lot of Beatles in what they're doing, but same time. Sure, Big Star, Cheap Trick, but at the same time, Charlie is such a good guitar player. Charlie Glenn, the lead guitarist and singer, is so good at guitar, and some of the stuff he does on guitar while he's singing is really quite complex.
That's the kicker, doing it while you're singing.
Right, and the fact that he's able to do it and that they don't just have three-chord songs, that he's doing these complex guitar figures while he's singing a pop
with
song.
With harmonies. And,
yeah, it's really incredible. The Trillions are really, they stand out.
Well, it was another incredible Richmond Folk Festival, and hard as it is to believe, we can now claim the world's best attended folk festival. Did anyone here go to the festival this year? And
this is the first one I've missed.
Oh, really?
Roseanne Cash.
Well, then I'm going to skip you.
You skip me.
I live across the street from it, so I
so you had
there.
No excuse, right? Well, I saw the Del Cuarto Tango Quartet, and it was incredibly inspiring. But that wasn't just the only one. Another one was Richmond's own Maggie Ingram and the Ingramettes. Fantastic gospel group. They have a new CD out called Live in Richmond that just came out that actually I wrote the liner notes for. So that is a blatant plug. But it's really good. I mean, I'd like it even if I didn't write the liner notes. But talk about how important that is to have the Richmond Folk Festival and how that's grown into such a really regional event, really. Anyone?
Well, of course, it's a catalyst. It was brought here as part of the National Folk Festival, and they sort of said, now it's yours. Mm-hmm. And there was a great deal of doubt whether, you know, because Richmond has a past history of fouling things up, to even when they're trying to do something good. And this one is a primary example of how things have gone well. And it's just so exquisite to be down there on a very fine late autumn day and to hear all that amazing music for free and see people that you've not seen. Maybe you see them once a year and you see them at the festival. It's a tremendous asset to this
region, an incredible collaboration between, say, the business community and the artistic community. How everyone seems to be able to work together. Now, why we can't do that when it comes to other, you know where I'm leading on this, Harry.
Broadcast of WIR is made possible in part by VCU Arts, a nationally ranked program featuring 16 visual, design, and performing arts departments and a campus in Qatar, arts.vcu.edu. I don't want to
go home. But as a co-founder of the Firehouse Theater, can you explain exactly what's happening at the Firehouse and why?
Don, I wish I could.
And why Carol Pearsall was dismissed seemingly without any reason. Well,
let me take my hat off now.
Right, right, right.
Take my journo hat off. Yeah, I'm co-founder of the theater. We started in 93, me and the four other founders. And
Including Carol.
And the situation, I think it's interesting that the last full stage production we had there was Death of a Salesman, and the executive board did exactly to Carol what is done to Willie Loman in Death of the Salesman for no reason, except that, you know, Carol's not delusional and is a better driver, I might add.
Right.
And her plans for the theater were robust and extensive, and she was unjustly let go. What's been heartening to me is the public recognition of that, not just in the theater community, but throughout. The supporters, everyone has been tremendously on the side of the art in this case.
Well, my understanding is that the board of directors were yearning for bigger productions, glitzier productions, but that would actually be a real change from the Firehouse's mission, right?
Well, it's 123-seat black box space.
Yeah.
Which produced shows on a frayed shoestring, particularly in the early years, they become a more elaborate, but still small.
Right.
And that's what people come there for. And as we've proved in almost 20 years of production, that people wanted to see that sort of show where they could witness it right in front of them, see the spit and
sling. But also more experimental. Right.
In many cases. Basically, it was a combination of we had older shows that people had not seen full-blooded productions of, brand new or recent off-Broadway shows, and original works that had not been seen here at all, world premieres.
Right.
And so that combination sort of put us in a different niche. And trying to make it bigger, I'm not sure exactly what that means. There's been some discussion about, you know, getting name brand actors. I don't know exactly who that would be to come act at the Firehouse. Right. As if somehow, if they're from New York, they're better. I think the whole thing is
certainly more expensive.
Exactly, more expensive. The mission has there's some mission drift that's occurring, I believe, and we're still working on a solution.
And right now, as we speak, there'll be a vigil.
Yeah, for 3 days. Unfortunately, for the G.
We're taping here Thursday night, but it'll be Thursday, Friday
and Saturday. Right. A silent vigil of people who want to support the mission of the theater, but also the community at large, because this was a wrong that was done not just to Carol, the Firehouse, but it was done to the cultural community. It's been very distressing watching this China syndrome disaster occur in front of you and really not be able to do anything about it.
Right.
And it's been painful and distressing, agonizing. Mm-hmm. And I think that the public sees this happening in all levels of government and commerce and banking and everything else. And to see it happen to something they actually have affection for in their own hometown makes them mad, quite frankly.
It's not the only contentious subject. The Richmond Symphony spent the entire year basically in a contract dispute with its musicians.
Yeah,
right?
That's great. And to give a little bit of perspective, what was the master agreement that had been in effect since the 08-09 year mm-hmm. was set to expire at the end of August of this year, or no, 2012. and they, well, let me back up even more and start by saying last year at this time, January 2012, the Richmond Symphony had asked and received sponsorship of a bill to eliminate mm-hmm. the ability of musicians to receive unemployment benefits.
Right, this was Manolo Lupassi's bill.
Yeah, right, and it wasn't just the Richmond Symphony that it would affect. It would be any symphony in Virginia, right?
Symphony.
But my understanding is that it was Richmond Symphony board members and management that approached Lupassi about this bill. Right. It didn't. It was put up for continuance. I've heard from the symphony that they're not going to pursue that again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Anyway, so then as soon as that kind of ended last January, they went into contract negotiations, couldn't reach an agreement. The master agreement that they had before had actually been changed twice, and the musicians' union agreed to two different sets of concessions, pulling away terms of the master agreement that mm-hmm. would have benefited them. So at this point, they're not striking, which is what musicians at other symphonies
sure.
around the country
which they've
done
before. The symphony, Richmond Symphony, is struck in the 80s.
Yeah, well, that was before I was alive. So.
Right.
and also, again, to put this in a national context, this is happening across the country, that contract negotiations are falling apart, musicians are striking, or the symphony locks musicians out, or, as is true in many places, there aren't problems. There are successful symphonies mm-hmm. all across the country.
Right.
So
Baltimore is doing pretty well, right? Is it Baltimore that's...
Yeah. Baltimore's doing pretty well. Philadelphia is not.
Philadelphia is having its own labor problems,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. They're quite a bit larger, and it's a little bit hard to compare the mm-hmm. The contracts there. But anyway, so the musicians are playing. They're currently playing under... a new contract that they did not sign.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going to happen. I'm hoping to talk with some members of the negotiating committee in mm-hmm. a couple of weeks to find out.
Yeah, and we hope to have them back, actually, on Open Source RVA for mm-hmm. the follow-up to their
yeah.
interview with
yeah.
us and find out what's going on. But it looks like people are dug in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and one of the points that the musicians make is that it's not – only an issue of, how much take-home pay a musician gets, which mm-hmm. It's the easy way to talk about it. But the bigger issue is, with cuts to pay and benefits and so on, will the symphony be able to attract and retain musicians that
yeah.
make it a professional organization,
mm-hmm.
really an orchestra of very high standards? No, they won't if they're cutting this far down. The other problem is that in addition to cutting musician salaries and benefits, the symphony also cut back the season. They now perform mm-hmm. fewer concerts, particularly the fewer Masterworks concerts, which
yeah.
are their
and that seemed to rankle them quite a
bit. It did because that's the only really unique service that they provide in this town. And their point was, if you cut back at what makes the symphony unique, where's it going to go from there?
Right, right. Rich, we began the year by 2012 by talking about Richmond's new downtown arts district and what that was going to be all about. But instead of unifying and helping the arts scene, this district seems like it might have created the schism that saw Christina Newton exit from her First Fridays leadership role. Talk a little bit about what's going on downtown and First Fridays.
Well, it's still there. Christina Newton's not there.
Right.
There was a lot of tension over running First Fridays and about the creation of an arts district.
Mm-hmm.
The original version, I think, that Charles Samuels was trying to put together was kind of smaller and basically in the area that we kind of consider First Fridays. The plan somehow ballooned to a 65-block district that's basically looks like downtown.
Yeah, and most people would agree that that's not really what those...
If you look at arts districts in other cities, it's a certain area to draw tourists, say, hey, this is where all the art is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, come here, go shopping. This district that they have, it starts, it's like Governor Street, basically the top of Chaco Bottom, runs all the way to Pine Street at VCU's campus.
Uh-huh.
It cuts down all the way to Canal just to get the Richmond Ballet.
Just to get the ballet, right?
And shoots way up almost to 95 in the middle of like Jackson Street and Jackson Ward. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge space. They're trying to package, I think, all of the different pieces of Richmond that make it cool, but it's downtown.
I have also a point to make about this, which is that as someone who writes about the art scene in Richmond regularly, you know, we do First Friday previews every month on RVA Magazine,
mm-hmm.
our website, and I write them. Well, there is just as much art going on right now on the First Friday nights in particular over on the blocks of Main Street between about the 1300 mm-hmm. block mm-hmm. and
Absolutely.
About the 1800 block.
Yeah, they'd be the first to tell you.
Yeah, as they there is, that's like a second First Friday art walk. It's about the same size as the mm-hmm. 1708 to Gallery 5 kind of stretch over there.
And then there's the Plan Zero.
True,
as well.
In Southside, that's a good point. I don't actually cover them. I probably should because I'm starting to see more and more listings for that Manchester area of Southside. So it's like this arts district. They made it really big when they didn't need to, and one of the predominant areas of art that's going on like a nightlife kind of basis in Richmond is not even included.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, that really needs to be, I mean, why do we need an arts district is kind of my question, but maybe that's not the right question to ask.
Well, originally they wanted it, right? Because the galleries wanted it.
That may be so.
To help ease some of the rules.
Well, it was supposed to be a kind of arts enterprise district.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. now it's just too big. It's unwieldy. They've tried to, again, this is mm-hmm. an example of Richmond trying to do something good and fouling it up in the process.
Right.
It's like a fishing cable. You know, they just get all tangled mm-hmm. up in it and it turns into a tragicomedy because
mm-hmm.
then they fall overboard. And everybody drowns. And that's kind of what's happening. Everyone's going to drown in red tape. And the galleries will still, the artists are going to still make art. It's still going to go up whether there's an art district or not.
Yes.
And so it's interesting, too, that with all the economic tumult that's been occurring the past few years, very few of those Broad Street galleries have closed.
Yeah.
The majors are still there, and most of the minors, too.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them that were going to kind of wobble, we're going to do that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a testimony to something,
right?
That there's also been new galleries that have opened. So we've got the art, we have the artists, and we have the population that at least goes to look at it. Whether they're buying it, that's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's interesting, though, that the city has gone from perhaps shutting down art galleries or the caps to trying to embrace it and making it.
Right.
That's a big change.
Right.
That's a positive change.
And I guess we should also mention another big arts-related story from 2012, and that was the big Art 180 controversy, where it seemed like the city legally permitted the art to go up on Monument Avenue and then took it down after some complaints. Actually, Charlie Deardorff last week on this program said that it was kind of a classic battle of Old Richmond versus New Richmond. Any thoughts on that?
Well, if we're going to have an open-air art conflict, why not have it on Monument Avenue, you know?
Yeah,
what a great place to do it. Our Champs-Élysées.
Right, right.
You know, right in the shadow of all the rebels. It was, well, again, here's another thing where it was interesting to see how the community came together over it on the side of the art.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few people who made a noise, made a stink about it, and they looked bad.
Mm-hmm.
The
city looked bad, too.
The city looked bad, too.
City should not have listened to those rich people who complained about it. Once they committed to it, they should have stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. But again, this points out to a leadership issue.
Yes.
And basically the willingness to cave at the slightest bit of pressure. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't bode well for your arts districts and your building, and even your festivals and so forth, because eventually there's going to be a problem somewhere along the line, and there has to be leadership. Someone's got to put his her foot down, stand up, and say, you're not going to shut this down because it's too important.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that brings us back to First Friday, because if you look at the controversy that occurred in the fall of 2011 around First Friday, and the fact that there was this huge outcry, and then they didn't do it around the time of Labor Day for 1 month. And since
this was
then,
when the youth came down, when the young people came down, yeah.
Exactly. And since then, there have been no problems. And what's interesting is, with Christina Newton gone, there's much less top-down leadership. It's basically the galleries deciding to do First Friday shows, and they do them. There's no head to that particular system of organization, and everything is fine. Mm-hmm. So,
and there's an argument that that stopped being an arts first event a long time ago. It's more of a street festival now.
You could certainly say that. I know that like Turnstile over there, which is a record store / clothing store that appeals to like electronic dance music fans.
Right.
They do events every First Friday, and a lot of times it involves them having DJs set up and play music. And it may include art, it may not. But yeah, they're capitalizing on the fact that this is happening in their neighborhood, and they can sell some merchandise, and who can blame them?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing. You know, Broad Street is more and more becoming a public gathering place. So you look at something like 1708's... In Light, and how people turn out for that. I think this was their third year.
It was more. Yeah. It was maybe fifth.
Fifth year of this, which is, and that's pretty tremendous. And, and you got your good years, and you're not so maybe a slightly off
well,
years.
Well, it seems like they do better when they stick to the downtown area.
Yes.
When they ventured off into other places.
And those were some, I mean, the Shaka one was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
It was quite good.
They've all been good. Yeah. I'm just saying as far
they've all had really great things in them.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, 804-771-5715 or www.kaufmanandknowles.com. How will I get the truth out of me?
Let's stay on this topic of dumping our creative leaders. Carol Pearsall, Christina Newton. Let's recount some of the others who've been kind of dumped or fired from organizations. Peter Mark from Virginia Opera.
Peter Mark.
He may have even started this wave off. Chris Maxwell, the founder of WRIR. It's a great story, but he was told to hit the road. We've got May Lily Lee, who was fired from WCVE's Virginia Currents for daring to find some outside work to replace her depleting salary. Christina Newton, of course. And I often wonder if how smoothly she got ousted might have played into the firehouse decision.
Well, you know, as Tolstoy said, all happy families are happy the same way. All unhappy families are unhappy differently. I think in all of these organizations, and there was at least a Toronto,
too. Oh, we've still got more. Yeah,
Tricycle Gardens.
Browns from Spark.
From Spark. And those have happened the last 5 years. These things have been going on.
Grant Mudge.
And Grant Mudge from the Richmond Shakespeare.
Jay all Ibsen of the, from the Holocaust Museum.
From the Holocaust Museum. Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty long list.
What is it about?
Well, I think part of it is maturation of nonprofits. And I think the deeper question, and again, this plays into our longevity endurance issues of these, all of these things we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to head it up at some point.
Right.
It can have a chaos theory approach, and that has its place.
Well, is it the same kind of visionary who can create empower these organizations may not be the same kind of person who can run them.
Yeah, be an executive in actually probably handle day to day.
And boards shift, and I've talked to a number of nonprofit people, and sometimes board people come on, they get on a committee, and they're great, and then they get into a position of power, and somehow it just all goes wrong, like a horror movie. Don't go in that room. And so it's a chance business, nonprofits, and it's even more chancy when you're talking about a nonprofit arts organization. It's not for the weak of stomach.
Right.
Really, it isn't.
Well, we had a prediction that came in from the Open Source RVA mailbag, and this one comes from a certain
Mr. Is there a special effect that goes
Mr. on? Like... Yeah, we'll put that in the background. From Mr. Scott Berger, I don't know if you know him. Scott predicts that there will be a push to make Gray Street downtown car-free. And branded as an Artie Street and perhaps renamed Altria Street.
Altria Street, that could happen.
This will be brought up at the TED Talk as the next big thing for Richmond. The taxpayer money should be diverted to now. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, they tried to do that in London. Red Ken, the mayor, tried to outlaw cars in the middle of London, and I think that actually went into force. It's been tried in New York many times.
Right.
But the businessmen who run the parking garages... you don't want to do that, Mr. Coach, Mr. Cock. You know, the love affair with the car. There's also the problems with Richmonders, like, I can't find any place to park.
I can't get them.
If they want to address a situation like that, the thing to address is the public transit situation in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, there are buses, and they're not bad. They could potentially be better. There are other options that could be put in place if you want people to stop driving their cars rather than forcing them to stop driving their cars.
But will those suburbanites do that?
Well, who knows?
Well, the bus lines don't run out there. That's a three-part series, my friend.
And it limits employment opportunities for carless people, which is, probably not entirely unintentional.
But I think this addresses something that this is all component parts. You know, the transit system... And the arts aspect of it, you got to get people there. That's why the bottom to the bottom and back bus is kind of interesting. And that way, I ride the regular bus just about every day, and I've taken the bottom to back bus too, because it's just simple and sometimes a quicker way to get to where I'm going.
Right.
If I'm particularly trying to get to a couple events, and so that I think is something the city and the region, but we don't really have a regional leadership. It needs to sit up and take notice if, in fact, they want to be this great world-beating city.
Right.
You got to start acting like one.
Mm-hmm. Let's do some lightning round. Quick answers to some quick questions. Angela, what arts initiative is going to grab our attention this year in 2013? What are we going to be talking about this time next year, you think?
Oh, gosh. I predict we're still going to be talking about the Atlantic Chamber Ensemble because they've got a great spring program coming up, and I imagine that next fall will be even better.
Cool. Okay. Rich?
Hopefully things are fixed at the firehouse in one way or another.
That would be a great story.
Let's. I'd say probably that.
Some sort of resolution that would please all parties. I don't know what that could possibly be, but...
Pleasing everybody in that situation is going to be...
That's going to be tough.
That's, yeah.
Andrew, what about you? What are we going to be talking about next year?
It's really difficult to say when, like, you pay attention to the culture on the level that I do, because it's the kind of thing that there'll be no prediction that it's going to happen. That's how I feel. I feel like whatever we're talking about in a year hasn't happened yet. It may be, you know, some new club opening up or a particular band putting on something, some kind of thing that knocks everybody out, or maybe there will be some festival this summer that will catch everybody's attention. Right now, I do not feel like there's anything I can point to that's obviously going to happen in the next 6 months that I can say that'll catch everybody's attention. So, yeah, I kind of got a punt on this one.
Will the VCU Institute for Contemporary Art, will it just be another bloated white elephant?
I'm really excited about that architecturally. Yeah. It's time for VCU to build something that's interesting.
Right. I'm a little concerned when I look at that board of directors and it's just the same old, it just doesn't seem like
there's
much
art. The heads of Easter Island?
Yeah, might as well be. Will it be just another one of those, or will it really be a kind of a grassroots catalyst?
Well, I think what really depends on is who they get to run the place.
Yeah.
I think that's ultimately where the rubber meets
the
road.
Well, they're starting pretty well there with Joe Seipel.
Yes, they are. And Joe has been an incredibly active, dynamic personality throughout the last really 25, almost 30 years of art making and art advocacy in Richmond. And it's just difficult to imagine where we'd be if he'd not been at certain places at certain times. The Richmond Magazine has its annual Teresa Pollock Prizes for Excellence in the Arts. We turned 15 this year, and Joe was our Lifetime Achievement honoree. And I mentioned in my remarks that the ICA is just a stone's throw from the place where Adele Clark and Nora Houston began teaching Teresa Pollock, who ended up founding the arts programs at what became Virginia Commonwealth University and the University of Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you could throw a rock at the school. It's a Pizza Hut now. It's a pizza place where the house stood. So I think this is, in fact, a realization, a culmination, really, of that vision that began in that dinged-up house that Major Dooley bought for his niece a century ago. And it's also on what used to be the Elba trolley station site.
They called
it Elbow Station because of the way it's shaped.
Right.
So it has it's right there at the intersections, and it's a gateway to the city, and people will notice it when they get off that ramp. That's for sure.
Yeah, you said you were excited about it architecturally.
Yeah.
It does look pretty cool. What artistic director at which respected arts institution is going to get fired next?
Uh-oh. Yeah, Rich. What do you think?
Yeah, Rich.
Gaze into that crystal ball.
I don't know. I mean,
Ashley Kistler, you're next.
God.
You know?
From what I can tell, the directors seem to the artistic directors and managing directors seem to have a very good relationship with, but I honestly don't know.
Right. I guess it'll catch us by surprise the way others.
Happens. Well, yeah, there's these shocks. Well, I had no idea kind of thing. I think, Don, one thing we'll be talking about next year will be the way the city's events are moving more and more into the street, more and more reclaiming the public spaces. Mm-hmm. And it's great to see, because this used to happen all the time in Richmond in the earlier century. And I'm not talking about the 20th, but the 19th, the early 20th part of this century, where the people went into the streets for street fairs, parades, and any number of activities that we sort of retreated because of the car. People didn't want to get out of them. They just wanted to zip through these streets because they were scared.
Right.
Because the brain-eating, child-eating zombies would attack them.
Well, they were out.
particularly in the early 1900s. But now we're kind of seeing a return to that kind of concept, and I applaud that, and I hope that that kind of thing will continue. Mm-hmm. Two things I want to mention really quickly, speaking of downtown and the art, but the Candela Gallery and Press, which has been an enormous asset, and it's been about a year and a half now, I think they've been open, bringing some incredible shows and
Gordon Stettinius and Mimi Ritchie.
It's just been an incredible asset. And also the James River Writers Festival turned 10 this past year and brought Tom Robbins back for a return engagement.
Right.
And that's been an incredible asset to the city in terms of bringing writers together who are necessarily, it's a solitary job, but they get to come together in, oh, I'm miserable too kind of way, and hopefully get talked up or talked down depending on where they are on the whole scale. But I think it's important that organization is still working and still bringing people together to talk about the craft of writing.
Well, we're just about out of time, but we didn't even mention some other big events that happened in 2012. It was the year of Chalhuly at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. Fantastic exhibit over there. And at the Valentine, they saluted the Richmond's love of tattoos with their tattoo project. And also the French Film Festival celebrated its 20th anniversary. And we had the Lion King come in and break some local box office records at the Landmark. So a very active year.
It's the cycle of life, right?
Yes, it is. And I guess we can end with this. What are the feelings about having Parker Agelasto on city council? This is not a minor thing. This is the first time an arts administrator has actually sat on city council. Do you think that we might have some more accurate projections on some of these projects that get funded, or what?
It'll be interesting to see his doodles when he gets bored, how that'll turn out. Maybe we'll see them on the internet. This is what I think Charles Samuels looks like.
I don't have a sense yet of how much backbone or how he can speak up you know, in the face mm-hmm. of people who disagree.
What she said.
As someone who lives in his district, I was voting more against the other guy.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of an issue. It was definitely not something where I really knew what he would provide, but it was like, well, let's see what this guy has to offer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it does come down to when one of these issues do arise, as it will. That's one prediction I will make. There will be some arts crisis, something right. related to
center
that.
Center stage will come back wanting more money
or something. And Mr. Rajalastam,
I can make that prediction pretty. Easily.
Somebody will have to say either yes or no on the situation, and we'll see. You know, mm-hmm. we'll just see.
And can we finally retire the phrase "Tier One organization"?
Please, can we please tier
retire one
that?
Anything?
I don't even know what that means. So,
Tier One?
Isn't that a place where you
yeah,
bought?
Yeah, Tier One. Tier One. Okay.
Well, isn't Tier One where you used to buy the cheap furniture that?
No, the wicker
college?
Stuff.
Yeah, the
sure.
wicker. That was Tier One.
Yes.
And on that note, I want to thank our distinguished panel, Harry Collitz, Angela Lehman-Rios, Rich Grisette, and Andrew Nachi, for appearing on this special.
And we're going to put a band together and go on the
road. Let's do it.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, January 11th, 2013. Just 50 weeks to go before we clear yet another long and lonesome orbit around our dim candle. Speaking of dim candles, looking to hear more from your favorite open source hosts at the top of their game? Check our website at rvaopensource.com for breaking news and podcasts of this and past week's episodes. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, whose celebrations continue south of the border till February. Our board ops are Brian Hill and, at least for the next couple of seconds, Rachel Solomon. Want to wish us well in the new year? Email us your comments, questions, and news tips at opensourcerva@gmail.com. Till next week, this is the end for which we twain are made.